good stuff, that's not bad. Okay, so, can I say something about these biophysics and the massive planet formation? And I'm going to start off by just saying something about how we believe, or how it was believed, that planets formed in the solar system, so sort of traditional view of planet formation.
Are you wired up, Phil?
I thought I was going to get away with that.
Charles
said I did.
Yeah. I didn't know that they were.
They may not be. And if they're not, then you're okay.
There's a little green light on. Is it on?
Yeah. You just have to wear it.
It's only 50%.
So now we've done our job, and if it isn't recording, then...
So we'll start by saying something about planet formation in the solar system. Trying to give an idea of where it's generally believed that the disk matters in the planet formation process. And I mean, in general, the traditional view of planet formation, the gas part of the disk is invoked as rarely as possible. And the question about whether the disk is turbulent or what nature of the turbulence is in the disk is hardly ever discussed at all, or believe that they matter very much. Let's say something about observations both in solar system and particularly in extrasolar planetary systems, which sort of raise some problems with this sort of simplest theory, particularly in the extrasolar planetary case. And then sort of finish up by saying something about one aspect, at least, of the interaction between planets and the disk, migration, and trying to get towards the idea of how important is angular transport, the nature of angular transport, in changing the way in which planets grow. Okay, so if we start thinking about how we're going to go from dust into planets, as we'll sort of see in the sort of the standard picture of how you build giant planets are just an extension of making terrestrial planets. So the fundamental problem is all to do with the solid component of the planetary disk, and what happens to the gas sort of comes along as an afterthought to that. So in that case, you've got to start with dust and the collapsing cloud and try and build that up all the way into objects of many Earth masses and size. So there are various stages in which it's believed this works, the first of which is going from actually dust up to just small size objects, maybe things the size of centimeters. And this first stage is not believed to be the most problematic. If we start really at the micron scale, then those very small dust particles would be well coupled to the gas. And so even if you had a model disk which had no turbulence in it whatsoever, it would take a very long time for those dust particles to settle down perfectly with gravity to be to the midplane. So if you sort of balance, if you work out what the terminal velocity of a particle size A is with bulk density rho dust, so that'd be several grams per centimeter, in a background disk with density rho gas, that's the CS, angular velocity omega, then you get this expression for the settling velocity, and for a micron of 1 AU, that's already something like a million years. So if there's any turbulence whatsoever in the disk, particles of this size are not going to settle at midplane, they're going to remain generally suspended. So pretty much irrespective of what you think is going on in terms of the turbulence in the disk, this earliest stages of growth has to occur via collisions while the material is basically still distributed over a fairly large vertical extent within the disk. And depending then on how strong you think the turbulence is, as the particles are growing, then they may be able to settle out vertically against gravity as they go from this sort of micron size up to centimeter size. So, this is the first stage, and in general, I think, both on the theoretical grounds, there's a lot of uncertainty about this because no one knows what these dust particles look like, and therefore, what particular mass, what their cross-section would be for collisions, are they sort of fluffy or not so fluffy, and so on. But both on the theoretical grounds and also observationally, if you look at the very large regions, large radii and protoplanetary disks, it seems there's some evidence for grain growth taking place, even maybe at 100 AU from the star, where the timescales are enormously larger than 1 to 10 AU, which is where you're normally thinking about planet formation. So both on theoretical and observational grounds, it's not believed at this step although it's uncertain, is a sort of great limiting step in planet formation. Okay, so then we then need to go from these sort of pebble-sized objects up to really things that are looking more like comets or small asteroids, planetesimals that are kilometers in extent. And this is a much more difficult problem because once we get to objects that now sort of bulbous sized, there's a very strong argument that says this phase of growth has to happen extremely rapidly. And the argument is sort of very simple. If you have something that's a meter or so in scale, you expect that to be largely decoupled from the gas, and so that will be orbiting the star just at the Kepler velocity, whereas the gas will not be orbiting the star at the Kepler velocity because it has some pressure gradient, which will be causing it to rotate somewhat more slowly than the Kepler velocity. So this sort of headwind, purely aerodynamic headwind that one of these boulders would face is not very large, it's only order h over r squared, and h over r is maybe 0.05 or 0.1 in one of these disks, so that's a percent level effect or smaller, but nonetheless that means, you know, 1 AU is 100 meters a second headwind that would be faced by a boulder. So if you just estimate how quickly rocks of different sizes would drift into the star as a result of this, you find that the timescales are extremely short.
Thank you.
Questions? So it only works out to be a few thousand or 10,000 years or something like that in order for objects, so this is scale, log scale, so this is 1 centimeter, 100 meters here. This is the time scale on which objects would drift into the star, different radii, and these curves, depending on how far away you are from the star, they have minima at different size objects, they're always in the meter scale size, which also depends on the density of the disk you're assuming and so on. The characteristically, they're less than about 10,000 years. So this is a big problem because you want to go from now centimeter-sized objects to many kilometer-sized objects in a time scale that's extremely short compared to this lifetime, which is maybe many millions of years. And the sort of thing that compounds this is that it's generally thought that collisions of meter-scale objects are not actually going to be very sticky. If you have meter-scale objects, then their gravitational attraction is obviously extremely weak. But imagine they would easily bounce rather than stick together. So how this stage proceeds is still extremely uncertain. One possibility is that somehow you manage to make a layer of this material, which is so dense, a solid layer, that it's gravitationally unstable. In that case, it would in fact fragment into objects that are sort of this quantum scale. But then there's the question, could you actually form such a layer? Would it actually be stable, even in the presence of disk turbulence, or just turbulence generated by forming that layer itself? And people have discussed that at great length. So however, somehow, clearly planetesimals do form, so there's a big uncertainty in this, that you get to this smaller scale, and you must do so very quickly. So this was just one way in which you might be able to get around some of these problems, or how you might get around some of these problems. Basically, the sort of suggestions here are in two classes. Either the disk in the region you're interested in doesn't have very much turbulence, so you can get this very thin layer to develop in the mid-plane, get this gravitational instability to go. The other possibility is perhaps if the disk is extremely turbulent, then maybe you can actually use this same thing that's giving you the problem, this sort of headwind that particles are facing. Perhaps you can turn that around. If you can actually produce some pressure maxima at radii within the disk, then you could reverse the sign of this the PDR term and actually just concentrate material in high-pressure regions within the disk. So one way to do that would be if you had self-gravity in the gas layer, you could then concentrate objects 10 meters, half a meter, you could concentrate them in these spiral arms, and you can actually locally get very high concentrations of material in this sort of critical size range with that kind of mechanism. Of course, this would require a large fraction of the disk to be self-gravitating, so that would be very appealing. Okay, so once you've got to planetesimals, then the next step is really to go all the way to terrestrial planets and the cores of giant planets. And in the traditional picture, this step really is independent entirely of what's going on with the gas in the disk. So it's purely an n-body gravity problem where n is very large. So maybe 10 to the 11 planetesimals if you have 1,000 solar mass of material within the disk. And basic concept here is if you imagine some of these objects are growing a little bit faster than the others, they're becoming protoplanets, then they will be able to accrete other planetesimals from some annulus in the disk, which will be governed by how far away the gravitational influence of the growing planet will be able to perturb those planetesimals. And that radial extent, delta R, will be a few Hill radii, where the Hill radius just depends on the mass of the planet and scales with the radius. This is sort of the motion lobe size and the limit of a very large mass ratio between the growing planet and the star. So the way it tends to work is that if you imagine doing this, you make one object a little bit larger, it has some Hill sphere or a few radii, a few Hill spheres which can affect the planetesimals, it will eventually be able to sweep up all the planetesimals within that region. However, as it grows in mass, as the planet mass grows, the size of this region it can influence increases rather slowly with mass only as to the one-third power. So as the planet grows, initially it has a relatively large spinning zone, it's just sweeping up these planetesimals. And then as the planet grows, eventually gets to the point where it's basically swept up all the planetesimals within its feeding zone, within this annulus. And then at that point, it's only a very slow process where it can accrete more material, which is initially further away in the disk.
So there's no end of the moon?
The moon is inside the Earth's Hill radius. It doesn't get accreted.
Right, so there's a range of orbits in the restricted free body problem which will pass within the Hill sphere, and some fraction of those will end up in collisions. Things are actually exactly so.
Could be really small.
You've got the planet, and here's its Hill sphere. So if you actually have orbits, imagine the orbits are imagine there's a very low velocity dispersion to the material planetesimals, then the orbits that are actually coincident with this will actually be horseshoe orbits. So you won't actually accrete those objects. And then there's a region which is, if you go out beyond maybe 5 or 6 Hill spheres, then planetesimals in this region are completely forbidden from ever entering the Hill sphere. So it's material which is sort of in this intermediate range of a few Hill radii away, which dynamically can enter this Hill sphere and will then undergo some potentially complicated orbit there and either be collide or be thrown out again to some other orbit. So things are not going to happen instantaneously, but this is the upper limit to how much you can. So this allows fairly rapid growth up to the point where you get to where this annulus is more or less depleted the planetesimals, and that gives you an isolation mass. If you just take 2 pi r, sigma delta r, plug in this delta r, you can work out what the isolation mass would be, and it just scales with how far away you are from the star, same major axis, and the surface density of planetesimals. So in just n-body calculations, growth up to this size is relatively fast. So this could get you to maybe 10th of Earth mass, obviously it depends on what you assume for the surface density of planetesimals, but this could get you up to maybe a 10th of Earth mass, a 1 AU Earth mass, or a few Earth masses, out of 5 AU, where you're making, you want to make Jupiter. So if we think just about terrestrial planets, once you get to this stage, imagine the growth beyond this stage is slower because you basically need to refill this annulus with more material, or you have interactions now between a number of isolation mass objects which are formed. So it's now got a small n system. So the growth beyond this stage is much slower, but people have done n-body calculations. They typically find you can quite plausibly form something like the Earth or the inner solar system in a timescale of about 100 million years. And that's reasonably consistent with what people think the times we are performing the inner solar system was, dating the last impacts that created the moon, things like that. It seems that those processes did take longer than the time scale which the gas part of the disk would evolve. So the solar system is a sort of consistent story. The final assembly of the terrestrial planets took longer than the lifetime of the gas disk. So reasonably, at least in the final stages, you could ignore gas in that process. And that's always consistent with dating evidence from the inner solar system. And if you ask, well, how would this work in different planetary systems, different protoplanetary disks, the dominant factor appears to do a whole ensemble of N-body calculations. So there's some recent ones by Raymond and collaborators. The dominant factor is just this sigma here, the surface density of planetesimals. If you wind up the surface density of planetesimals, you get fewer terrestrial planets, and each of them is individually more massive. So there are other things that would matter. If you have a giant planet in the same system and so on, that's sort of first order, the first thing that matters is just how many rocks you have in that region.
All these arguments rely on circular orbits for the ground planets.
Yes. Well, except for so they're circular orbits up to this stage, given basically just a free body problem on circular orbits. I mean, the in-body calculations have been done for the final stages, are obviously not assuming circular orbits. Something one might mention is that, you know, how well do these calculations do in reproducing in a solar system, and the possible problem is that it seems that, you know, the Earth and Venus have perhaps two circular orbits compared to what you'd expect. If you imagine that inner planets usually were finally formed from maybe 20 or 30 pretty large objects that eventually collided to leave you with four inner planets, then you might think the typical eccentricities would, you know, correspond to the spacing of those final objects that collided, and that gives you eccentricities that are significantly large compared to the observed eccentricities. So, you know, some people, you know, have talked about, do you need a very small amount of gas to finally circularize the terrestrial planets? So, yeah, the problem, the thing that's most often discussed in terms of a problem with making the Earth is potentially that the Earth seems to be on a very circular orbit compared to what we get in some of these simulations, but it's not a five sigma effect. Okay, so that's got the terrestrial planets made in this picture. Well, what about the giant planets? Well, the picture of the giant planets is a bit of an extension of this. So if you now imagine you're now out at several AU in the disk, so here's the disk in radius, here's the vertical extent. We formed a solid core, maybe a few Earth masses, out of that radii by this same mechanism of colliding together planetesimals, getting a runaway growth. And what's then imagined to happen is that around this core we have an envelope in hydrostatic equilibrium, which sort of extends out to the radius where the planet's gravity would dominate over the disk. So that might be the Hill radius, might be an accretion radius, depending on what the sound speed is. So the situation then will be, we have a core, we have an envelope, here we have the disk gas, and this growing core has managed to evacuate roughly the planetesimals within some annulus around it, but it's still continuing to grow at a slow rate by kicking out more planetesimals from the edges of this feeding zone. So there's a sort of picture here where it's a sort of stellar structure problem. You have a core, some planetesimals are raining in on this core and producing luminosity rather close to the core boundary. That luminosity is then flowing out through the envelope. And then we have some boundary conditions we have to match at this outer radius, which may be the Hill sphere. So the growing planet has a luminosity both because it's accreting planetesimals, and also the gas is flowing into that from contraction of that gas gravitation from that gas. So you can make a growth model for Jupiter this way, which consists of a series of quasi-static states where the core is normally assumed to remain at a fixed orbital radius. And that then amounts to a sort of stellar structure problem where you don't know the mass of the object you're considering in advance, but you don't know how much gas you've got within this Hill sphere, but you do know the radius of the object as a function of mass, and that's fixed by this Hill condition. So when people do those kind of models, sort of two ways to think about it. The simplest way is to imagine just what are the static solutions for the problem, so you can plot core mass, this is in units of Earth masses, against the total planet mass, as a function of the rate at which planetesimals are just assumed to be coming into the core. So say that's have a constant value. And what you find characteristically is these sort of curved over solutions where you can start with a low core mass. As you increase the core mass, planet mass increases initially pretty much linearly. The envelope at that stage has a rather small effect, a rather small mass compared to the core. As you go further up, the gas fraction gets larger, and eventually these curves turn over, and there are no solutions beyond that for a particular planetesimal accretion rate. So for any particular planetesimal accretion rate, and these curves are plotted here for a very wide range, these are actually order of magnitude changes in the planetesimal accretion rates, so large planetesimal accretion rates appear, getting smaller by orders of magnitude going to the left. But for a particular rate, there's a critical core mass which you can't exceed and remain in this kind of static situation. So the idea is that once you exceed this point, you'll get rapid gas accretion, and there'll be basically a switch over from a significant part of the luminosity coming from this planetesimal accretion, the situation where all of the luminosity is coming from gravitational contraction on Kelvin-Helmholtz quantum scale of the planet. And if you do this for many different outer boundary conditions, temperature and pressure in the nebula, you find that this critical mass doesn't depend too strongly on what the conditions in the nebula are, because although most of this is convective, there's a radiative outer boundary which connects with the nebula. So, and then convert that into a sort of time-dependent model for the growth of Jupiter. This is very similar to what was done by Pollock. Here's the core mass, total planet mass. You get a fairly rapid growth initially, as you're sort of clearing out this annulus planetesimals, getting a bit beyond that. You then have a very slow phase where you're just stepping through these quasi-static solutions, and then eventually you get to this sort of critical point, and then that point would be when the gas would run away. And the baseline models can be calculated, typically find something like this one. The critical time scale in this runaway is about 10 million years, and the core mass works out to be about 20 Earth masses. And something to note, which we'll come to, is that you can make obviously this time scale shorter by increasing the rate at which planetesimals are raining in on the core, so by having more solid material there. But if you do that, that means you're going from one of these curves down here to a curve further to the right. You tend to increase the core mass you get at the end of the process. Likewise, you can reduce the core mass by reducing the planetesimal accretion rate, but that's at the expense of having a much longer formation timescale for the planet. So you can't simultaneously make it shorter and lower core mass within this sort of picture.
Do you keep track of how fast the planets are rotating
at the same time? No. This and, as far as I know, everything that's been done on this has purely spherical symmetry. Not even estimating how much angle there is. Okay, so that's sort of how it might work. Now, if we think about how well that works in the solar system, well, this whole picture was sort of developed for the solar system, so obviously, overall features work pretty well for the solar system, but there's still a number of problems, and most serious of those, possibly, is that the core mass of Jupiter is believed to be substantially less than is obtained in the simplest versions of this core accretion model. So this is a plot from a recent review showing estimated values for the core mass in Earth masses and the total mass of heavy elements in Jupiter, which are obtained by comparing measurements of the gravitational field of Jupiter, the multiples of the gravitational field with interior structure models for Jupiter. So the main uncertainty for Jupiter is that one doesn't know very well the equation of state, the conditions prevailing in the center of Jupiter. So these two confidence regions here are showing what you get for different assumptions about the behavior of matter near the core of Jupiter. However, even in the highest core cases, there's some up here, it appears the core mass is sort of 10 Earth masses, and then what you assume for the equation state would even be consistent with having no core in Jupiter at all. So the upper limit on the core is something like 10 Earth masses, maybe a little bit more you can allow. And as mentioned before, you can solve this problem by reducing the planetesimal accretion rate, but only at the expense of increasing the formation time. And in the standard picture for doing things, the formation time is already 7 or 8 million years, and so there's not a great deal of opportunity for making that time scale much longer. So that's Jupiter. Do the same exercise for Saturn, and Saturn's core seems to be okay here. So this is the same thing. Conditions here aren't quite extreme, so there's not so much uncertainty about the equation of state, and you work out, you do have maybe 15 or 20 Earth masses of material in the core. So that's the core masses. Other problems that someone's mentioned in the solar system, the formation timescale of the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, naive extension of this model out to greater distances, will come up with very large timescales for building Uranus and Neptune. And so the two possibilities discussed here is one, well, maybe you didn't form these objects where they are now, but you formed them closer to where Jupiter and Saturn were, where the timescales would be shorter, and they subsequently moved out further. This is normally considered in the context of scattering of planetesimals. So imagine you form four planets reasonably close to where Jupiter is today. There's still a lot of junk left over. That junk's got to be removed, sent out to the Oort cloud or Kuiper belt or wherever. So that's going to be happening by scattering of the planets, and that will tend to lead the planets moving outwards, because the way that happens is that Uranus and Neptune themselves won't eject much material, but they will scatter material into orbits across Jupiter. Jupiter will then do the actual ejection, and in that chain you'll be moving the ice giants further outwards. So one possibility is migration of these planets. Another possibility is that perhaps the material which the planets are accreting from is dynamically very cold. In that case, it can be very strongly gravitationally focused, and you can reduce the formation timescale. That depends on the size distribution of the objects you're considering, and therefore how collisional they are, and whether they will cool. So this is a big debate between Ramsari and people like that, and Hal Leverson, corrected two extremes of these camps. So that's one possible problem. Other things that are note, if you look at the Kuiper belt, there seems to be an edge to that out of about 50 AU. So it seems that there weren't any planetesimals out beyond that sort of radius. Many Kuiper belt objects that are found out beyond that radius, but those just on the outer parts of eccentric orbits. So maybe this represents either the outer edge of the protoplanetary disk, or perhaps it represents a region of the disk which can actually form planetesimals, and you couldn't form them further out. If you want to form planetesimals via gravitational instability, maybe there's evidence of that, because the only way to make that work probably is to enrich the material in the inner disk well above normal solar values. And then there's also this very recent discovered object, Sedna, which doesn't fall in this picture at all, because it has semi major axis out at 500 AU. In an Oort cloud object, you might imagine this is, but it's much closer in than where the Oort cloud itself is believed to be, which is out at 10,000 AU. So what this is and how this fits in the picture is not very clear at all. Most speculations say this has got something to do with the stellar environment in which the sun formed, perhaps with much higher density of stars early on, and therefore you could sectorize orbits out at 500 AU rather than out at 10,000 AU, where perturbations from the galaxy today become significant. Okay, so that's the solar system. What about the extrasolar planets? Well, in that case, in those cases, the amount of information is much smaller, but the number of systems is much larger. And in the majority of cases, there's only really four pieces of information, three or four pieces of information that are known about those objects. The planet mass, up to the fact that it depends on the inclination of the system, which is normally unknown, the semi-major axis, the eccentricity, and the metallicity of the host star, and the mass of the host star as well. So you can plot those quantities and see what you get. Here's a plot of semi-major axis versus eccentricity. All the red objects here are discovered by radial velocity searches. The bulk of these, there's five objects here, which are blue, which are objects that are discovered by transit searches. And then the green squares are the planets in the solar system. So here is Jupiter. So what you find here is that you have some planets that are very close into their parent stars. So we've got Jupiter's inside 10th of an AU, well inside where Mercury is, and the closest in here is down to a period of just 1.2 days. So it's really extremely close to where the stellar surface would roughly be. And then if you look further out, maybe at 1 AU, you find there's a larger population of planets there, and they have a roughly flat distribution of eccentricity going from 0 up to values of about 0.7 or thereabouts. So there are one or two outliers, as an object here with an eccentricity beyond 0.9.
Is there a transient one with an eccentricity of 0.15?
This, I mean, it's almost certainly 0, but that's just a number that's crazy. So, I mean,
you mean there's a big error bar?
There's a huge error bar. Okay. So it's, okay. Everything down here is consistent with 0. If you plot closest approach to the star line on this, it will roughly, does roughly outline the left hand band there, so it would be consistent with tidal time spatial condition. And in terms of the number of stars that have been surveyed, sort of roughly solar type stars, there was some extent in masses, electric types. The sort of raw frequency is about 5 to 10% within this radial range, out to maybe 4 or 5 AU, and with some mass limit, which corresponds to something substantially less than a Jupiter mass. Mm-hmm. Close in, maybe a tenth of Jupiter mass. For these close objects, more like a Jupiter mass, or even more than a Jupiter mass, out 1 to 5 AU. So at least 5 to 10% have these massive planets, and presumably, of course, the frequency is much larger than that, because there's all this apparent space out here, and also the lower masses, which is not yet accessible. Here's a plot the mass against the same major axis, same data here. This is radial velocity amplitude on the star up to 20 meters per second, which was sort of state of the art a few years ago. See, it's now a number of objects with smaller amplitude that they discovered. But more or less, you can see that the observed objects pretty much fill the whole range of parameter space, which is accessible. So, you know, some discussion, for example, is there a significant lack of very massive planets in very close orbits? Some evidence for that, but it's not entirely overwhelming. What is certainly true is that, you know, the typical planet is out here rather than in here. Small radius, you have a larger range of masses which are accessible than you do at large radius, but you actually have a smaller number of objects, even just in this raw count. So, at the moment, it would not be unreasonable to say that the situation in the solar system, where the giant planets are out 5 AU and beyond, that might well be the typical situation. There's no real data out there, but the trend is clearly pointing towards having a larger abundance of planets as you get out towards that situation. Then if you plot eccentricity versus mass, you don't see really very much. Blue points here are the short period planets. So some of those have very low masses because they produce quite large rate of velocity signatures on the star, so the sort of selection effect you have to be aware of there. And also circularized. But if you consider the other systems that maybe tidal effects aren't so important for, doesn't seem there's any strong trend, at least, of eccentricity with mass. Now, maybe a problem or an issue if you want to make eccentricity by interacting those planets with the disk, because you normally expect that process of making eccentricity by interaction with the disk would probably be more efficient at large masses than at small masses. I think the general expectation was no evidence for such a thing over this mass extent. Then the final piece of data one has, which I think is very suggestive of what's going on, is to plot the frequency of planets around host stars as a function of the host metallicity. So there's not a huge range of metallicity plotted here, solar, minus 0.5, plus 0.5 in the log. But there's a very, very strong trend in planet frequency over that range of metallicity. There's nothing with a stellar metallicity less than 0.5 solar, though not many stars surveyed, so nothing extremely significant there. But as you go to the high metallicity end, it's clearly a very significant rise in the planet frequency, and it's reaching 15% or something within these same parameters of orbital radius and mass, planet mass, reaching 15% from just a few percent, factor of 3 or 4 less in metallicity. And it's pretty well established now that this really does reflect the primordial metallicity of the gas which formed the star and the planetary system, rather than some kind of pollution of the convective envelope happening later. The strongest evidence for that is if you look at masses, stellar masses, where the convection zone is very shallow, you're going to see a much stronger effect in those stars compared to stars where the convection zone is much deeper. So this does appear to be a primordial metallicity, and it seems to correlate very well with planet mass. So this seems to be very consistent with the expectations of core accretion. In the core accretion picture, certainly you up the planetesimal surface density, you have a very rapid rise in how quickly you can form a core that will reach runaway growth, more than linear in the metallicity. And it doesn't seem to be consistent with what you'd expect if you formed these planets, at least from any kind of gravitational instability, where what the trend metallicity would be is not completely clear. But one might think, and people have even published things to say, that high metallicity might make it harder to fragment the disk. When you have more opacity, it would be harder to cool that material. So most of the observed HDL planets, it seems, didn't form from disk instability or from fragmentation during the process of star formation. That said, there are certainly some unusual systems that maybe make you want to pause. Here's a couple of examples that are known. Here's one system where you have two planets. This inner one has something like seven Jupiter masses in M sin I. The outer object is 17 Jupiter masses in M sin I, so there's a minimum masses. Masses are almost certainly larger than that. So here's a system where you have a newer planet, which would certainly be counted as a planet, quite similar to some of these other systems that were on those previous plots. But it's actually not that far in radius from another object, which is a brown dwarf type masses, and which might well have formed from fragmentation or some kind of disk instability. And at the moment, the situation is that, you know, if you go back to this plot, it would be very nice to make this same kind of plot now split up in masses of the planets. So you could say, is there actually a significant difference, or very massive planets, which perhaps may have had a different formation channel from the lower mass objects. And at the moment, there just aren't enough of those objects in order to make a statistically significant statement one way or the other. At the moment, it would actually be consistent to say that the more massive objects seem to favor lower metallicities than the less massive objects. But that's two sigma or something statement. And other things like the eccentricity distribution, which you might think would also be different if they formed in a different way, those things are completely statistically consistent as a function of mass. So, more planets needed to really address that. Okay, so what can we say about solving some of these problems, like the HDL planets in this question of the core mass? Well, one mechanism that's discussed a great deal is migration, and what's meant by that is simply gravitational interaction between the satellite and the gas disk, which leads to angular momentum exchange between the planet and the disk. Location of resonances within the disk. That angular momentum exchange leads to change in the orbital elements of the planet, migration, and also leads to a perturbation in the surface density of the disk. And this is very analogous to what is seen in ring systems. This is a pretty recent Cassini image of Saturn, where you have a gap that's being created by a small moon in that system, and you have some locations where you're generating waves within the disk. So this is a particle disk and a very collisional particle disk. And you know, people have measured how sharp this edge is, these gaps, and it is extremely sharp. We can go from sort of full surface density to zero over a matter of tens of meters. And the whole thing is only tens of meters thick. So here you can see these things very directly. Now if you go to the gas disk case, things are a little bit different. This is just an illustration of how things work. This is a 2D simulation of turbulence in this disk, just some prescribed constant kinematic viscosity. And what I've done here is just take a planet, started off at three Earth masses, let it rise linearly in log mass up to 10 Jupiter masses. And you do this slowly enough. This is an almost co-rotating frame, the moving chain, so that this is sort of in steady state, roughly steady state, at each mass. So what you find is that, you know, for low masses, get the full masses, you get these waves exciting the disk. But for low masses, the planet remains completely embedded within the gas. As the mass increases, you start forming one of these gaps, and eventually as highest masses accretion onto the planet across the gap starts being cut off. Exactly what masses that happens depends on what you take for the disk parameters. This is the surface density as an average during this. So the normal distinction that people make here is sort of between these two regimes, type 1 migration, where the planet remains embedded within the gas, so at this point can be a large effect on the motion of the planet and migration of the planet, very rapid migration potentially, but the effect on the disk is basically negligible. There's no significant surface density change to the disk. The amount of angular momentum that's being transported by the planet is very small compared to the amount of momentum being transported in the background disk. And that regime applies for most of this models for masses around an Earth mass and smaller. And then type 2 migration is the final state where you have one of these large angular gaps in the surface density, which for some other things applies for around about a Jupiter mass. So if we think first about the type 1 migration, but in this case, in the case where there's no turbulence within the disk, the background properties of the disk, and think of how much viscosity you have there, don't matter so much for estimating what the migration rate is. However, there's still a lot of uncertainty just in making the analytic calculation of what the rate should be in that case when you get beyond the situation where the disk is two-dimensional and isothermal. So if the disk is three-dimensional, the disk is three-dimensional, and has some complicated vertical structure, then there's a lot of uncertainty about what rate that would be. Further, one takes one recent estimate, this is Tanaka et al. You find that the migration velocity, the radial velocity of the fraction of Kepler, depends on the mass ratio between the planet and the star, depends on a sort of measure of the local mass of the disk, planet radius squared times the surface density divided by the stellar mass, and it depends on the temperature of the disk while the h over r ratio at the point of the planet. And the striking thing about these kind of estimates is if you sort of plug in numbers here, like a minimum mass solar nebula value for the gas surface density, h over r 0.05, you get something like 1 centimeter per second per Earth mass as the migration velocity. So 1 AU, the time scale for an Earth mass, is only 500,000 years, the spiral in towards the star. And if you went up to 10 or 20 Earth masses, which is what you're thinking about for making giant planets, then this time scale is getting appropriately shorter just by that mass. So if this estimate is at all accurate, then certainly planet's cores are not forming in situ, and it's very hard to imagine that you have this time available in order to have this slow progress of getting a more and more massive envelope put together. Another way to plot that, shown here, is the mass ratio between the planet and the star. Green line, which is of course not visible here, would be the sort of critical core mass for Jupiter. And these blue lines show typical migration time scales. Blue one would be for a migration time scale about 1 million year, and this lower one is actually a 50 million year migration time scale. So you might imagine if you're above this lower blue line, there would be some effect of migration on the growth of cores via core accretion. Things wouldn't be exactly static, they'd move by several Hill spheres during the lifetime of the gas disk. If you're above this line, this 1 million year line, then migration ought to be the dominant effect in growing giant planet cores. This red curve shows the isolation mass in this same disk model, and it lies closer to the 1 million year point than it does to the 50 million year point. So if this estimate is sort of at all right, you can see that the cores don't form in situ, and it's very hard to reach a critical core mass before without losing the core to the star. So if you have some migration, a small amount of migration is very helpful for core accretion, because that enables you to move into regions of the disk where you haven't depleted the planetesimals, so solves the lost cone problem for building giant planet cores, but a large amount of migration gives you a very rapid accretion of planetesimals, raises the critical core mass, and makes it then very difficult to reach a critical mass before you're lost to the star. So this is for a very simple disk model. Of course, the details will depend on the true background disk model, and as we all know, particularly at few AU, there's a great deal of uncertainty about what the background disk actually looks like, due to the fact that it's partially ionized and we don't know what the MRI would be doing in that circumstance. So that's sort of the one view of type 1 migration. Over some recent work, sort of questioning how this actually works, and the basic idea here is that if we consider a turbulent disk, so this is a disk, just surface density perturbations from a MHD calculation, so blue and red are plus and minus perturbations, slice 3D isothermal calculation, there's actually a lot of structure in the surface density, and it's not at all axisymmetric at the percent level. So the sort of perturbations one's considering in type 1 migration are very small. You think of an Earth mass embedded within the gas disk, it's perturbing surface density in these waves only by a very small amount.
But is there a planet in there somewhere?
There's no planet.
Okay.
Actually, at this stage, though, is that really being controlled by MRI? Or is, I mean, it looks like one of your old paraboloid supernova simulations in this late stage.
Good old paraboloid.
This is MRI.
No, it's Nelson and paraboloid here.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, why is there such low M structure?
Okay, so I'll just say, so this is actually a calculation which has a band below. So that's actually enhancing. So
okay.
You may actually just be able to see, which I was hoping you wouldn't see. There is actually some real structure actually in the band below here. And that is actually enhancing the low M contribution just outside. You just plot the stress from this, that has much more high end furniture.
This is density?
This is density.
There you go.
And it's also, you know, just quite warm HRRs and one.
So is the ideal energy
case
for
the
appropriate for a large range?
No, that's not at all appropriate. But so if one considers sort of these perturbations, you look at what the potential fluctuation is, then because then you are averaging vertically, so actually you do actually suppress a lot of high M power. So you end up with power more in the low end range because you're averaging vertically. And for something like this, one gets a potential fluctuation to something like the 10 to minus 4 level. So most of the potential doesn't come from the star, and then you only have a small contribution from the disk. However, these sort of random perturbations are lasting for an orbital period, so they're quite short. So they are actually quite favorable for transferring angular momentum to turbines. You're not just getting angular momentum transport to location resonances now, because the perturbations themselves have a time dependence. So if one thinks about how this might work, the torque you would get from these fluctuations will also scale with just the planet mass, whereas this type 1 torque we've been talking about scales with the planet mass squared. So it would certainly appear that if you have the low enough masses, then effects due to the turbulence in the disk will dominate over collective effects due to having the planets there. In simulation, it's not entirely clear how well these are additive. Does the presence of turbulence actually change the type 1 migration rate or sort of supplant it? But when Nelson and Papaloizou continue these simulations for a while, plot running averages, there is a sort of convergence towards seeing something like the type 1 behavior when you have very long averaging intervals, not altogether short.
So why does the turbulent torque depend on the mass?
Well, just from the fact that the force is dependent on the mass of the planet. So there'll be no mass dependence on the rate of migration. So in this case, the rate of migration scale is 1 over the planet mass squared, 1 over the planet mass. In this case, it will not depend on the mass at all. So just as if they were test particles. So these are actually from the Nelson and Papaloizou calculations. This is for 10 Earth masses.
Nice sunset.
And you can just about see in this case the sort of type 1 wave when you look at that. But the sort of dominant structure you see is just the MHD stuff. So if you ask, well, what's the sort of critical dividing line between these two regimes, type 1 migration, and where you'd expect sort of random walk behavior for cores embedded within the disk, then Pavlovsky will have this about 10 Earth masses. You can sort of see from an image like this, you can just about see that there's some overall effect, but it's really almost washed out by the turbulence. Boffin et al. Actually have a much higher transition mass between these two things. Mass would be in the type 2 migration regime. So this is ideal MHD, so this is probably not the relevant regime where one's really thinking about core accretion, thinking about 5 NAU, where it will not be ideal MHD, but it is coming from simulations that end up realizing quite inefficient angular momentum transport. So the equivalent alpha from this, for example, is 7 times 10 to the minus 3. So, you know, is that a reasonable, how efficient angular momentum transport at 5 AU in the real disk? Obviously, one doesn't know. But if it's extremely inefficient, then one probably runs into problems with having a lot of material accumulating in that part of the disk during the evolutionary sequence. So it's unclear how applicable this is, you know, at the radii of greatest interest for core accretion. So if this is what is actually going on, of course, this doesn't actually help the survival of planetary cores. Certainly, if the torques are additive, it just makes things, in fact, even worse, because now they have not only a linear drift, but they also have some large random component. So instead of just moving in towards the star, they're now running around like crazy as well, and they're even more likely to hit the star early than they would before. But it does have a large effect on core accretion, because in there, if you can move from one part of this, not just in a sort of a systematic way, but instead in some random way. So that may actually change then this sort of otherwise quite close coupling between the core mass and the timescale for planet formation. So here's again this core mass, planet mass plot for these static models. And the basic idea one might have is that you have depleted some region of the disk of planetesimals. You still have plenty of planetesimals outside this feeding zone. If we now imagine sending this core on a random walk, we can move it to a region where there are more planetesimals, get faster growth towards larger masses, but then if we move back into a region where we've actually depleted the planetesimal surface density, we can exceed locally the core mass, in the critical core mass in that point. So we can sort of build in the regions of high planetesimal surface density, but then run away when we re-encounter regions that have been swept out before. So this would be one way to make this work. Another possibility is to go to think about multiple core formation. And imagine if we have many planets which are competing for planetesimals, then at some point they'll notice each other, maybe because they're forming side by side next to each other, maybe one's already formed and migrated into the star and cleaned out the whole region of this planetesimals, and that can do the same sort of thing. We can be growing on one of these curves and suddenly find ourselves starved of planetesimals and run away at a low core mass in a short period of time. So we did this thinking about this random warp process. Here's this sort of standard picture for building Jupiter. They allow the core to move a few tenths of an AU just in a random warp fashion over a few million years. And indeed, you find you get a very large reduction in the time scale it takes to get this runaway growth. And the idea would then be that some of that time scale reduction can be traded off for a smaller core mass. So you can try to satisfy both of these problems simultaneously. Okay, so
how do you I didn't understand that. How do you trade it off for a smaller core mass?
So what you do is, if you just do this on its own, you just build things faster, but you actually have the same core mass. If you then reduce the global surface density of planetesimals to a half of the minimum mass on that middle value, which in the normal case would take 20 million years to reach runaway, then your time scale goes back to 5 million years or 6 million years. But you end up with 10 Earth masses of core as a result. So that would be one way of doing it. Okay, so just saying something briefly about the type 2 case. Still plenty of uncertainties also in type 2 migration, one of which is the disk model, because when we have migration taking place, will then matter entirely how much angular momentum transport is taking place within the disk. There's another question, even in purely laminar simulations, the point where the gap is just at the point of opening, still some material within the gap. It's extremely difficult to obtain convergence for that case. I don't think it's been demonstrated that convergence has been obtained. So estimating the torque at the point where the gap is just opening remains extremely uncertain. And then, of course, there's turbulence. It's a turbulent calculation. Getting itself going, here comes the planet, and indeed it's clearing out a gap. That also is now more much more structure in the disk, and properties of the turbulence of these gap edges may well be significantly altered by the presence of having a planet there. So one thing here in this whole area in general is, does this interaction lead to growth or damping of the eccentricity? Most calculations, all calculations done today, find that the real planet masses, Jupiter masses, you get damping of the eccentricity, but if you can make this gap a little bit wider, perhaps by suppressing transport near the edges, then maybe you could get eccentricity growth there. Okay, so go on with the sort of type 2 migration thing. You can sort of certainly make a game, believing it seems very likely that this is a good model for the hot Jupiters. You make a sort of toy model of this. We imagine the planets form large radii within the disk. They migrate inwards within these gaps as the overall global structure of the disk evolves, and they're then either swallowed by the star or they stall as the gas globally is lost to the disk, like over evaporation or whatever one's favorite process for getting rid of the gas is. So this is, of course, potentially quite a wasteful process. The star is just continually swallowing planets one after the other, and depending on how fast the disk evolves, you may have to end up making many planets in order to get some to survive. However, if you do that, you can sort of reproduce roughly this growth in the number of planets with radius from the star. So it's a sort of consistent picture for why you see a small number of hot Jupiters, a larger number when you get out to 1 AU, going out towards many AU. And the prediction here is certainly that you would expect a significantly larger abundance of planets still embedded within the protoplanetary disk than just by taking the more statistics and using that as a baseline. You have these earlier generations which are now not observable in late stages, and there's some evidence for that from spectral energy distributions. We did some work modeling Gianariga. It's a Spitzer data on 50 power 4, where it appears there are gaps, holes in the inner disk, which may be due to planets or may be due to.
Wouldn't you think that would lead to a more chemically homogeneous nebula? If you're just constantly feeding material?
It need not, because, well, it depends on whether this sort of turbulent migration is a large diffusive process for planet presence. If it's not, then having a giant planet passing through the inner disk, it will accrete 10% or a few tens of percent decimals, and remainder, if they recircularize, will be pretty much the next dimension of it. So in that case, it's fine. Of course, if you say that it was a very large diffusive component, then it would smooth things out. So the data there is, how homogeneous is the asteroid belt, and certainly you can think of a very narrow division in the asteroid belt. With a few tenths of an AU, then it's very hard to allow any significant diffusion to take place. I don't understand that data well enough to really know how strong a constraint that is. Okay, so that's just the summary. I think the identification of type 2 migration with these hot Jupiters is a reasonably good identification. Eccentricity is the other strange feature of extra planets. It's a big problem, though. If you like gravitational scattering, nothing to do with disks at all. Gravitational scattering actually does seem to work roughly in producing the eccentricity distribution. So there's no reason to believe gravitational scattering might not work, though you then require multiple planet formation to be extremely common in those systems. Type 1 migration will certainly be overwhelmed by turbulent fluctuations of low masses. This has significant density perturbations. The place where that might, in fact, matter the most is in terrestrial planet formation, looking close enough to the star that really the disk will be more probably ionized or a bit very large radii. And however, if you could manage to get this random warp migration to persist up to core masses and the Jupiter radii, then you, you know, you do have an extra way of explaining the small core of Jupiter. Okay, stop there. I thought the scattering actually doesn't work because we would expect too many circular orbits for the observations. That's only true if you restrict yourself considering scattering between equal mass planets. So, you know, certainly true if you consider the scattering of equal mass planets, then there's a problem in that you get too many collisions, and collisions tend to be too circular in the observations. However, I think when you, you know, redo that calculation, or if we've done that calculation with a spectrum of masses, still in the case of just considering, you know, two planets more or less arranged to be at the Kelvin boundary, then you can do that pattern. You don't have such a problem with collisions using two circular things. So I think it's okay, though. Clearly the parameter space for such models is extremely different.
You haven't said anything about the tensile strength.
These things. Is it understood what happens? This is another version of things. Is it able to stick together and then shatter? Well, you normally shatter, but in typical models, you then reform. So you have things that are 10 kilometers in size, then self-gravity will be the dominant force over there, unless they're much stronger than you would sort of expect. Self-gravity will be the dominant force over internal stresses. So when you hit them, when two of those collide, typical models, it's kind of, it works, the velocity dispersion is low enough that you don't just smash them apart. So you smash them into a cloud, but then it will reform. So it would be a concern if you added, you know, so much extra energy into the system that you got to the point where you really were blasting them. Much harder than escape velocity, and then they would also be frozen apart in many pieces.
Could you comment on what Laughlin et al. Have made so that their simulation, I mean, their calculation finds it from the more to much higher masses?
Yeah.
They don't actually.
Right. I don't fully understand the difference. I mean, what they do is quite sensible. Basically, what they're doing is they're saying we're taking the amplitude of potential fluctuations and their time dependence, and you know, from that you can calculate how the velocity dispersion would change with time, or how much random warp you get. So you know, that's quite a good way to, a reasonable way to approach it. You know, without doing, the problem doing it directly from the simulation is that you need to average this for a long period before you can possibly see an overall effect. One thing is that they assume a very simple form for the potential fluctuation.
Yeah, but doesn't that suggest that there is something where, I mean, the way they characterize the turbulence is not right, or that there is something else?
Yeah.
And just the density fluctuation there.
They're just giving them the benefit of their thoughts of how it ought to work. There was nothing behind it. There wasn't a simulation. Just thought, what would be reasonable for the turbulence? That's very dangerous.
Well, that is
a Gaussian model.
They had a simulation too. Right. So when they went through the other thing, they.
Any other questions? No, let's thank Bill again. Thank you.